to understand the crisis. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me pass on straight away to Magnus.
Okay.
How many minutes is it? 18? A little bit more. Yeah. I had a feeling of it.
Well, also I should say thank you very much for the invitation. It was a very surprising and humbling invitation, but definitely an honor. So I'm very, very pleased to be here. My contribution to the debate will turn the gaze to the academy as well, actually, and particularly towards European integration scholarship. And I will suggest that the crisis is a crisis of many things. It's a crisis of the social model. I think that many people in Greece feel that there is a crisis, but I also would suggest that there is a crisis of European integration scholarship, the crisis of the Eurozone. And why? Well, the Eurozone crisis is the latest metamorphosis of the global financial crisis that was triggered in US subprime markets in 2007 and which spread through channels of securitization. Why did the most prominent representatives and organs of European integration scholarship issue next to no warnings, indeed had virtually nothing to say about developments leading up to the crisis? In preparation for this paper, I did a survey with the journal Common Market Studies from 1993 to 2009, so from the inception of the single market today, a time when the crisis was in full swing, and I found 5 out of 732 articles that had anything remotely of relevance to the topic. Actually, one of them was by Walter Schäuble, and another old colleague of ours from Brunel University, namely Deborah Mabbott. This is my argument in brief, and I'm going to try to keep it brief. This is actually, as Matt advertised my forthcoming book, and this is an argument that I make in the book, and I'm also finding myself incredibly challenged to do this in 15 minutes, but I will try my best. And basically, I'm trying then to explain why this silence, which I have suggested is something reminiscent to international relations, not being able to sort of see the end of the Cold War coming, which was a discussion around when I was a PhD student. And I'm trying to sort of find an answer to that. And the answer actually is good news for international political economy, I think. So, So basically, I would say that despite its virtual ecosystem of different analytical models, European integration scholarship, most European integration scholarships shares a common denominator. And I think that Kuhn is very, very useful for making sense of this. Kuhn suggests that paradigms have codes, and I would say, leaning on Bourdieu, orthodox codes that are prior to any theoretical rules. There is something sort of that is shared before theoretical debate begins. And drawing on Bourdieu, I suggest that this orthodox code is based on instrumentalist, reified abstractions that idealize Atlanticist integration. So Atlanticist integration is idealized in this context. And this, I would argue, prevented thematization of developments generating the Eurozone crisis, since these emerged out of interrelated production power relations that are constitutive of Atlanticism itself, namely in the form of a crisis of a US-centered finance-led accumulation regime. So these sort of, particularly this power relation, these arbitrary aspects of the Atlanticist relationship is something that is missed because of an idealization of Atlanticism and integration scholarship itself. Now, that's quite a claim. And in order to make this, to substantiate this claim, as I try to do in the forthcoming book, I would need to go through a number of steps, at least 5 different steps here. I would have to... And I'm not going to be able to go through all the steps in detail here, so I'm going to be very schematic and then just sort of pick a number for further elaboration within my time. First, I would have to define orthodox code, drawing on Kuhn and Bourdieu. Then I would have to be able to identify the code of European integration orthodoxy, the reified abstractions of European integration orthodoxy. And basically, I'm not going to be able to talk a lot about this here because it means a huge review of a large body of literature. But broadly, the argument is that there are two reified abstractions, or one can label them in the following ways. First, the disciplinary split between an economics of integration and a political sociology of integration. European integration scholarship is very, very immune towards interdisciplinarity, such as, for example, illustrated by or exemplified by international political economy, actually. International relations embraced international political economy after the end of the Cold War. European integration scholarship has been very, very immune towards this. So still, basically, integration scholarship continues to be split between an economics of integration and a political sociology of integration. So on the one hand, you have the economists who are steeped within the neoclassical synthesis that abstracts the economy from social relations and power relations and has a strong a priori market equilibrium bias in their analytical models, a priori. On the other hand, you have the political sociology of integration, which certainly does look at social relations, but reduce them to density of individual social interactions and abstracts away economic concerns from their analysis, basically deferring that to the economists. And power becomes understood very exclusively as power in government. So social relations become reduced to density of interactions. The second reified abstraction is the integration telos, which is an idea I got from reading an early piece by Robert Cox in 1976, not very well known, where he actually explicitly critiques Ernst Haas. And the integration telos is basically, there is this sort of sense in European integration scholarship a priori that somehow economic and political integrations are themselves expressions of general rational human potentials. So that's what I mean with the idealization. And the question is one of whether the integration process will be able to realize these potentials in face of the constraints of the parochial, special, national state interests. And this then frames a rather one-dimensional debate between optimists and pessimists. So you've got your neo-functionalists, your supranationalists. You get, on the other hand, your realists and intergovernmentalists. It's already sort of, tone is set by the exchange between Haas and Hoffman in the 50s and the 60s. And then from there on, we get a bunch of middle positions broadly framed by regime theory. I also think, actually, that most constructivist research, there are exceptions, but most constructivist research and multi-level governance approaches fall within these middle positions. Okay. This is a claim I'm going to have to throw out, and we can debate it further. I'm not going to talk a lot more about this here. I'm going to go on. What I would next have to do is I would actually have to sort of demonstrate how these reified abstractions actually permeate the way in which the economics of integration and the political sociology of integration actually have dealt with monetary and financial issues in the European Union, particularly with reference to the liberalization of the financial markets, the creation of a single market in financial services, the Financial Services Action Plan, the European Monetary Union, and so on and so forth. I am going to talk more in detail about that. Indeed, that is going to be my prioritization as I go on and elaborate. Finally, what I'm not going to be able to do much in detail in my introductory remarks, but this is where we get to the good news for international political economy, that I actually think that what European integration scholarship needs in order to make sense of how we got to where we are today in the Eurozone and to actually meaningfully debate parameters would be to take a good dose of international political economy. And I talk about this in the book in terms of the prospects of a heterodox recasting that you can explore at the margins of what is published at the about the European Monetary Union and the financial services. It's not that there isn't things written about that is relevant to what happened with the Eurozone crisis. But you do have to look at the margins of the academia and not into the mainstream journals if you're going to find it. And I would particularly draw attention to the contributions of regulation theory from the very, very outset with a number of interventions by Alan Lipietz and Robert Boyer already in 1989 and 1990, published in New Left Review, Labour and Society, a now defunct journal associated with the International Labour Office. And in more recent times, I would point to people like Engelbert Stockhammer, who I think came the closest to actually predicting the Eurozone crisis in an article in 2008. And what was so endearing about Stockhammer was that he's not sort of beating us up to the chest and saying, oh, I predicted the crisis. Rather, what he's trying to do, publishing in 2008, is, you know, we have all these contradictions mounting up. Why has nothing happened? Why is the bumblebee still flying? Of course, when it actually was published, that had been resolved for him. Regulation theory, I think, is very interesting because it draws a synthesis of a Europe's indigenous social mercantilism, which was popularized by a bunch of French industrialist academics such as Jean-Jacques Servan-Schreiber already in 1967, and Michel Albert, of course. It's also influenced by the neo-Marxist response to Servan-Schreiber in the form of Mandel and Polanzos, and also by post-Keynesians like Kalecki, John Robinson, and Minsky, actually. And, of course, what is very useful here is contra the a priori equilibrium bias, is that post-Keynesian and neo-Marxist theories start from the inherent instabilities of the market system and then tries to understand how it is historically and temporarily stabilized and how that institutional stabilization then generates contradictions that gets into trouble and we get crisis. And the whole concept of finance-led accumulation, I think, has been very, very useful to understand the crisis. I would also draw attention to the contributions by neo-Gramscian and neo-Weberian work with concepts such as hegemony and infrastructural power that has the advantage that it considers a power at the very outset of societal integration. I would not be advocating replacing one orthodoxy with another, but rather what I would suggest is that recasting the orthodoxy and moving away from these reified abstractions would provide a way of recapturing insights, for example, from optimal currency area theory, constructivist work on the power of economic ideas, or maybe what Paul Krugman called the magical thinking of neoliberalism, and indeed maybe order liberalism. And I think there are even here ways of recapturing rational choice institutionalism and even neo-functionalism. But I think one has to move away from these reified abstractions of this orthodoxy. How much time do I have, Matt?
About 5 minutes tops.
Okay, then. So I am not going to talk about the Orthodox Code. I'm not going to talk about European Integration Code. But I am going to talk then about how these codes permeated the disciplinary split, and particularly this idealization, the telos, informs money and finance in the economics and integration. Basically, I think you can summarize the economics of integration as being sort of technical studies broadly within an agenda set by the three major reports behind the single market, the Cecchini report, the Padua-Cioppa report, and the Sapir report connected to the Lisbon agenda. And basically, it treats the efficient financial market hypothesis and theories of sound money as straightforward offshoots of Bela Belas's version of trade theory. So money is just another commodity, and we should trade it, and the more we trade and transact it, the better. And quite remarkably, the Sapir report, in terms of the rationale of the Financial Services Action Plan, basically saw the financial services as a way of copying the US model in order to achieve high-tech investments in Europe. And there was no kind of sense that actually what was going on was that it was feeding a large myopic speculative bubble in real estate. So this is sort of one line, and then that's sort of more broadly taken a priori for the subsequent technical studies that are taken within the agenda in economics. You also have your endogenous optimal currency area theory. Optimal currency area theory obviously is something, has a potential of saying something fairly profound. about what is going on right now. But quite clearly the dominant approach has been the endogenous optimum currency area theory, which basically says that the financial markets and the European Monetary Union are themselves going to solve the European currency area problem, so we don't have to worry about it. Slightly more subtle are, and this dovetails with what Brigitte was talking about in terms of ordoliberalism, are they neo-Keynesians associated with the European Central Bank. They basically depart from the problems created by price stickiness and imperfect information in your standard workhorse ISLM model. And they envisage that there are transition problems in liberalizing financial markets that, particularly as we get the hot monetary flows coming into the south, and this might require higher precautionary surpluses than what the Growth and Stability Pact prescribed. You can actually find certain studies of people associated with Vito Gaspar, the head of research of the European Central Bank, making this argument around 2005, 2006. Now, a couple of interesting points about this is that they consider the Growth and Stability Pact not to be hard enough. And I think that this is a very, very important intellectual context for understanding what is going on today. And that is the way that they are understanding the crisis. But a number of things here. They note that these financial flows are not going to investments, but they're going to consumption. But they do not try to explain this anomaly for the Sapir report. They just sort of move on from there, nor do not try to explain it. They do not take into account the fact that this was actually not a transition problem, but rather it was a crisis started in the role model financial market in the United States. Okay, so that's basically what the economics of integration has to offer. In the political sociology of integration, we can be fairly quick because it really doesn't have much to say. I think Moravshik is actually quite representative here. In 2006, he argued that the credible commitments of the Maastricht Accord had made the European Union institutionally stable and mature. So basically, you have a deference to the economists on the equilibrium generation of free markets. And as long as we have strong enough density, even the most intergovernmentalist skeptical of them say, well, there is enough credible commitments here, it is stable. Quite instructively, and this is actually, we're talking, I'm pushing here on the strongest ground. And, I'm a bit unfair picking on Enderlein and Verdun here. I mean, at least there is some political economy here. But quite remarkably, in 2009, they are still saying basically it's hunky-dory on the basis of an analysis based on endogenous optimal currency area theory and an old favorite of European integration, namely spillover. Interestingly, the American version of IPE that sort of tries to find politics in the wedges of the neo-Keynesian stickiness have some interesting things to say. And indeed, Benjamin Cohen is one of the five as well. And here, basically, it's framed like this. The euro cannot challenge the dollar, but may have done enough to reduce U.S. capacity to delay and deflect. In other words, to dominate the financial system globally and to be the consumer of last resort. And this, if the euro does enough to sort of unset that, this has potentially ominous implications for hegemony in the world economy. And I think that that is something that is very, very important to an important dimension to what is going on here and that we need to grapple with. And then within this sort of genre, we have Cohen, Kirchner, and Posen taking slightly different points of view here. But ultimately, also here, the analysts remain remarkably sanguine about financial markets, for example, in an article by Cohen in International Affairs in 2008. And certainly, they have nothing to say about the mechanisms that generated the financial crisis in the first place. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.